And here we are. So, welcome to Comedy Northwest Podcast. By the way, it's called Comedy Northwest Podcast.
Ah, okay.
So, yeah. If you ever want to check it out, I guess.
Not podcast in a room where obviously many porns were shot?
Yeah, I can only imagine. They had to paint that wall red because there was just so much red spatter across it. They needed to blend in.
Menstrual red. What kind of red would you call that?
This one?
Yeah.
I would say
like clown blood,
like a forehead gash.
Oh, okay. Like Ric Flair red.
Yeah. Somewhere around there. And that voice that you're hearing is Big Jim.
Hello.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm down here in Bend doing some wicked awesome comedy.
Wicked awesome comedy. Yeah. So yeah, we were just watching Fever Pitch. We're sitting in that room right now. So now we're all basting on things. So, Jimmy over there.
Hey, what's going on, guys?
Hey.
What's going on, man?
Fucking wicked.
Fucking faggots.
amazing, pretty good show last night.
Very interesting show. An interesting cross-section of America showed up to Chaos.
There was a group of, I think, 8 ladies that called themselves Trailer Royalty Vintage. Trailer women.
Yeah, and I inadvertently or overtly refer to them as trash.
Yeah.
Because I swear, at one point, I think during Jimmy's set, they refer to themselves as trailer trash.
Yes.
You know, and so when I guess that's their word. Like, I can't drop the T word on these, like, old biddies and expect it to fly, so.
Well, it seemed to be some sort of a combination between Stepford Wives and Joe Dirt.
That is a very astute observation, I would say. Yeah. Because they all kind of had like some kind of hive tiara mind going on.
Yeah.
In that, like, if one of them didn't find something funny, none of them laughed.
Yeah.
But if one of them laughed at something, then the rest of them were okay with it.
So we performed comedy at a Kubrick movie, is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
That's exactly what happened.
So, yeah, that was a little awkward. But no, they the entire time they were all smiling.
Yes.
And at the end, they said.
So do serial killers before they strike, too. Yeah. You know, it's all smiles, then here comes the hatchet.
And yeah, they said at the end that they enjoyed it. But it was just so hard to get them to laugh.
Yeah.
And of course, they were sitting right there in the front, middle. So, yeah, and their damn tiaras sparkling at you.
They had tiaras and just really heinous Christmas sweaters.
Yeah.
Which I didn't know if they were wearing ironically or not ironically.
I think they were old enough to not be wearing them ironically.
Elderly hipsters? They exist. Oh, they exist.
No, really? Yeah, they're called hippies.
That's why they didn't laugh that much.
Damn it.
We're hipsters.
Yeah. Now we solve the puzzle box.
Fucking hipsters. Hate hipster audiences. God like, damn
These
it.
These guys are all right. They kind of remind me of like maybe an early Lenny Bruce before he quite had it figured out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of profanity. A lot of interesting racial slurs being used in interesting ways.
Yeah.
I feel.
Kind of absurdist. Yeah, you guys are all right.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go through the regular questions really quick here.
Okay.
We'll do the lightning round back and forth. Big Jim first.
Yes.
And we'll go over to Jimmy. So, how long have you been doing comedy?
Oh, first time I ever did comedy or attempted comedy was the third grade for a talent show. And what I only knew was Bill Cosby himself.
Mm-hmm.
So when they called my name at the assembly to get up in front of the judges to see if I was good enough, I just started with side one, joke one of Bill Cosby, and I'm like, doing it in a Cosby voice.
Yeah.
So imagine like a little third grade Jimmy Willig going just like, dentists tell you not to pick your teeth with any sharp metal
And
object.
You didn't continue with that? That's the best.
I was going with it. And
I
like,
assume that you killed. I mean,
I was holding my own for like a minute or two, but one of the women stops me, and she's just like, you can't do that. You cannot do that. I'm like, I can't do what? She's like, you can't do another comedian's material. I'm in the third grade. I'm not going on tour ripping off Bill Cosby openly. I'm not Carlos Mencia.
Your third grade teacher was Louis C.K.
No, it's Mr. C.K. You can't call him
Mr. C.
You don't call him by his first name.
God damn it.
So, but my whole point was like, ooh, the girls right before me aren't Tony Basil. They didn't write Oh Mickey, You're So Fine.
Yeah.
Yet they get to sing that.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
But I can't, you know. I mean, I wasn't going to go in blackface or anything like that. I was going to go. It was St. Anthony of Padua Elementary School, you know. But So that was my first roadblock in comedy that I had to overcome. And then I tried again in high school back in like 97, also at another talent show, which I ended up losing to, which I don't know when talent shows became a contest. I thought it was just like, it's a showcase of talent, hence a talent show.
Yeah.
There were awards given out, and I lost to two guys that were reading from scripts, and they were reading the Dead Parrot sketch from Monty Python.
Aww.
And in their defense, they were really good, but they didn't have it memorized, and they actually
in high school all you have is time to memorize Monty Python.
That's blasphemy. And they beat me out, and I was doing all original material as a junior in high school, and I killed the room.
Probably everyone there thought they were doing original material.
If you can't drunkenly recite all of Monty Python's Quest for the Holy Grail on graduation night,
what good are you?
Then you have wasted your entire high school career.
You should die in a drunk driving accident.
Yeah.
If I have anything to say about it.
So let that be a lesson to all the high schoolers out there. Memorize Monty Python, everything, and you will survive.
And you'll get all the girls.
Yeah.
Because that happens every time.
Mm-hmm.
But
eventually.
You'll get all the
girls. When you discover self-worth.
Just one last thing quickly about that other talent show that I did. When they announced my name and I started walking towards the stage, no one clapped or responded. And I have this on video cassette. That's how old this is. I have this. My parents were in the front fucking row.
And they didn't
nothing. They're just like, no, he's done nothing to impress us yet. We should not reward just they called his name. That's not an accomplishment.
Yeah.
That doesn't garner any actual applause. I walk up. It is the most coldest sound. My foot falls on that stage as I'm going towards the microphone. I didn't even have a microphone. Yeah. I just had to basically rock-a-pella it out to the audience. So, and I ended up killing the room just talking about my elementary school experiences at Our Lady of the Iron Fist.
Yeah.
So. That was my first actual successful attempt at comedy.
Successful? You're going to say successful?
You lose. You lose, sir. Good day. You got nothing out of that.
That seems to be a very general word that you're using there, that definition.
The term success gets thrown around a lot around Big Jim, and clearly it's not being properly used.
Yeah. So over the other one. How long have you been doing comedy?
The other one.
Jimmy, I'm sorry.
I am infinity.
I was attempting to go back and forth as quickly as possible, so feel free to take your time.
Yeah. I have no beginning or end, sadly.
I am a constant.
I guess since we're taking the more, I can't even talk, the more long-form approach, I guess I've been making people laugh for a long time, but I've only been doing stand-up comedy since 2006.
Really?
Yeah.
And you've got this good since 2006?
I took a break, and then I because I got scared that I'd done everything I could, and then I came back in 2008. So roughly, I would say since 2008 is fair.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, see, I pointed to myself when you were talking about the talent show, because my first attempt at comedy, I'm pretty sure it was second grade, I think.
Okay. Oh, you got to beat me by a year. That's fine. That's
so, whatever. Yeah, whatever.
You're better than me at everything, Ron.
But you stuck to it a lot longer than I did, because you went from third grade to, what, 16?
That's
where I went from second grade to, like, 22.
Gee, okay.
So my hiatus was a little bit longer than yours was. you know, I just needed more time to write material, work at it, you know, before I get myself back out there. But no, my first attempt was at I'm pretty sure this is what happened. I don't remember specifically. But I know that my prime motivation for doing stand-up comedy back in second grade was because I could get out of class for a couple minutes. There was an announcement over the intercom that said, hey, anybody who wants to be in the talent show, go to this room. And the teacher looked around, and I'm pretty sure made eye contact with me. I'm like, okay, let's try this. I was like, yeah, I'm going to be in the talent show.
The ultimate comedic motivation. Avoid real work.
So
at second grade, you had that instinct already.
Yeah,
good.
Yeah.
That's a solid thing.
So, and here's the best part, is that I had no idea what my talent was.
Wow.
So, yeah. So I was like, yeah, I'm going to do it. And the teacher's like, doesn't even ask.
Hidden
okay,
talent competition in the teacher's lounge.
Now, let's play a game called
Secrets
Who Can Keep a Secret?
Plenty. All you can eat secrets.
Oh, my God.
So salty. Yeah.
So secrets often are.
Oh, yeah. So, okay. So anyway, so I'm on my way to the room where we're doing it. And I get there, and the teacher who was putting it all together recognized me, like, oh, hey, Ryan, so what are you doing, like comedy or something? Yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing.
Were you kind of class clownish, or?
Sort of. Yeah. I tried to be.
Second grade is one of those years where you start to kind of define your personality. Yeah. First grade is just about, like, eating glue, you know, and just sort of hanging out with your friends, you know, and, you know, if you went to my elementary school, getting, you know, hit by the teacher, that kind of a thing, so.
Yeah. The part that I am for sure remembering is the second I'm two steps towards the mic and then two steps away. Everything in between there is what I remember, because I wrote down about a dozen knock-knock jokes on a piece of paper and was just reading them off. That was my, yeah. But here's the worst part. I had a fucking heckler. A kid that was a grade ahead of me, and I knew who he was, just started saying all the punchlines to my jokes as I was doing it.
Oh,
every single one.
Cad.
That's the worst kind of heckler,
yeah,
too.
I
just
know,
like,
right?
I'm just going to steal all of your shine.
Yeah. So that's why it was a little bit harder for me to get back into it.
Well, you know, on a brighter note, that kid died of leukemia like two grades later.
Probably.
So just,
yeah.
It was like a savage leukemia.
That's what happened
too,
to Steve Martin. People shouting out his punchlines, lost interest.
Yeah.
Couldn't continue.
He's like, if you guys keep doing this, I will make Bowfinger. I'll do it. Don't even try and taunt me.
He stuck to it.
And he did it. And he did it. And that, oh, geez, what was the one with Queen Latifah? That was the other
one.
In
the house?
Just to make sure that he was serious, he did that one. Apparently, we didn't learn our lesson the first time. Okay, next question.
Yes.
What? I guess you already said what got you into comedy.
Well, yeah, the first actual comedy album that I listened to was my sister purchased a Bill Cosby tape. It was Bill Cosby himself.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't even have like a stereo. We had like one of those like rectangular tape recorders.
Yeah.
And so we all sat around like old timey style and listened to the tape recorder.
Yeah.
And I just remember my your life bores me, sir.
Touche.
But no, we would actually, I remember us having to keep hitting the pause button because we were laughing so hard and we didn't want to miss the next thing that Bill was going to say. So, like, that was my first, you know, interaction. So, and Bill was, like, all long-form storytelling.
Yeah.
Very, you know, he was like the old dirty bastard of comedy, at least in my eyes, in that he had just had no real father to his style.
Yeah.
And so I went from him, and, like, my sister's next comedic tape that she purchased was Sam Kinison, Louder Than Hell.
Wow.
And so I thought all comedy was, like, what I'd see on TV. Very, like, you know, obviously he wasn't on TV at the time, but very Bob Saget, very, you know, clean cut, very, like, obvious and pretty cheesy. Sam was the first guy that just, like, when I listened to that album, I just, like, my world was changed forever. And so my dream, even as a young kid, was I wanted to be a cover comic and just do Kinison's routines and call myself the Son of Sam. And I would get, like, the trench coat and the beret, you know, and I would get his mannerisms down, but I couldn't get the laugh quite right.
Yeah.
You know, and so I just would emulate him in every possible capacity. And, ultimately I kind of created my own thing and just kind of went off from there.
And so, wait, how old were you when you first listened to Kinison?
I would say probably 12 or 13. So right at that young adolescent age. So, like, a lot of the stuff that he was talking about, I didn't even really understand.
Mm-hmm.
But I could hear. What was driving me crazy was there were so many visual jokes that I wasn't getting just listening to the album.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm like, I got to see what he's doing, because there'd be a silence and he would do something and the audience would just lose it. Like, I got to know what that was.
Yeah.
And so years later, when I could actually find it on VHS or whatever, I would watch those and just completely be enthralled by the whole thing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Steve Martin talks about in his biography about he specifically did his albums with as much physical comedy as possible.
Yeah.
So that people would constantly, like, people would laugh, but then walk away with the mystery of, like, what did we miss? And that's, and, you know, it would draw people in and bring them to the shows. And that's got his celebrity.
Brilliant.
I know.
Brilliant.
Jimmy.
What was the question again?
What got you into comedy?
First, shout out to Big Jim for not only referencing the old dirty bastard, but then quoting Method Man to explain what he was talking about. It was brilliant. I'll tell you, I was an actor for a while, And I thought that acting was a little too serious, and I didn't really enjoy that aspect of it. I thought, because I just wanted to make people laugh, and I really enjoyed sketch comedy, and like The State and Monty Python and, you know, Kids in the Hall and whatnot. So I didn't really know what to do for a long while. But I think the first thought that I had that I could be a comedian, I was living in Toronto when I was recently married at the time. And this magazine in Toronto had it was called Now Magazine. It was like an online and also, you know, on the street publication. Mm-hmm. And they had a Do Scott Thompson contest, who is Scott Thompson from Kids in the Hall.
Yeah.
And I was like, that sounds amazing. It was just like a, you know, impersonation contest, and Scott Thompson was going to be the judge. Mm-hmm. And you got like a small prize, but mostly I was thrilled. I was like, well, this sounds fun. Like,
that prize was feeding Scott Thompson's ego.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And he won. He won that night.
What a dick. No one does Buddy better than me.
Exactly. So that's funny, though, because I did, they just said, you know, send us a quick email saying why you want to do Scott Thompson. So I gave a very, you know, very brief, like, just love and respect his work. That's about all I said.
I want him inside me.
And so
stroking
like,
him as
sure,
gently as possible.
Come down and do it. And I did Buddy Cole. I wrote my own routine based on Buddy Cole.
Nice.
Oh. And went out. The big joke that killed, especially with him, is that I was like, you know, there's a lot of sexy individuals in here tonight. And one person stands out in my mind, though, and that person's name is Scott. And looked over at him and said, Thompsonberg, and looked out at the audience. And that killed pretty hard. But he chose me as the winner, so it was pretty exciting.
Right, you know, on! Wow,
just to hear cool. Scott Thompson say my name, like, yeah. Jimmy Neustadter won, I was like, whoa, I got really embarrassed really quick. But he asked me afterwards, he's like, are you a comedian? And I said, well, no, I'm not. I'm an actor, I like comedy. And so that was, like, really the first time I thought, like, well, if one of my favorite comedians ever thinks that I'm funny, then maybe I could be.
That's fucking huge, dude.
Yeah, that's cool.
That is amazing.
So, what was your first comedy experience like?
I mean, it was really
the first time in which you said, okay, I'm gonna do stand-up, and then the following time on stage.
My wife had left me like earlier that week, I think. True story. Because I had moved to Portland like probably six or seven months prior, and I knew that moving to Portland, I was like, it's a bigger city, I'd like to try comedy if an opportunity presents itself, you know. I didn't know how to do it, though. So after my wife left, I called up Harvey's, which I knew was the comedy club in town, and they said, yeah, we have an open mic this Sunday, you know, come down at this time, sign up, whatever had happened. And when I first went there, Jim was at one of the first open mics I was at, but not that one. When I first went in there, one of the comics, like I didn't know was a comic then, but I certainly figured he was probably a higher ranking comic because he talked through everyone. Loudly in the back of the room, and just talked through everybody's set. And when I got up there, and since I had been so used to acting, I was like, these people are just reading off of pages. This is going to be easy. And so I'd work, you know, extra hard to memorize the last tidbits of my set. I think I had a shot of peppermint schnapps because I wasn't really a drinker then, but I wanted something that will make me a little more calm and also not make my breath stink. So
I had a barkeep, peppermint schnapps on the rocks.
They banned me forever.
Like, seriously?
No. Get out of here, creep.
But your breath smelled terrific.
Uh-huh. But it was really bad. I had a conceptual idea that I didn't know it was probably the worst idea I could ever have, but at the time, but I tried it and then tried it months later too, whereas I thought it'd be funny to say that I got a job as an underwear model for Sears kids underwear and then like kind of revealed because I went all out. I bought Spider-Man underwear at the store. I went for it and kind of revealed that I had some Spider-Man underoos on to everyone's appropriate sheer disgust, and took me a little while to get to dig my way out of that grave.
To erase that stigma.
So the only real laughs I got were when I started talking passionately about, halogen lights in cars or whatever they are. They're really, really bright ones. That I would say, like, every time I see them behind me, makes me feel like God is coming to claim my life. And so I went on to this spiel about saying, you know, please, if this is the end, like, spare my life, I'll never blow Japanese businessmen for money again. Just kept calling that back. And then, you know, said, and then the car passed me, and I proceeded to blow a Japanese business.
Back to what you were doing.
So I, the lesson then and now is be honest, and I still don't get it. Still making stuff up for fun.
Yeah, I think that that is one of the most common mistakes that I've seen in amateur comics is that you when you're going early, you think that doing some sort of physical visual bit
yes.
is funny, but it's not.
No.
Yeah, you're telling jokes at the audience. You're writing stuff that you think is going to make them laugh as opposed to taking something that you already find funny
yeah.
and just kind of rewording it and making it so it's universally understood from your standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
You're basically like, you know, you're rewriting the verbiage around something.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's also one of those things is like, well, I'm not a personality, so me taking off my clothes isn't funny. It's just disturbing. If I was a character in a movie, maybe.
Yeah.
You were talking about, Jimmy was talking about being an actor. That was really the kind of thing that kind of got me going in that arena was my dad was an actor and did a lot of directing and musicals and community theater and stuff
musical
like that.
Musical snuff films, that's very impressive.
Well, you can only do it once, sadly. It's only a one-time performance, then you got to leave town.
Yeah.
And a lot of moving around as a kid, a lot of changing of disguises and makeup. But the first time I remember seeing him on stage, and like the lights were up, and he was in costume, and there was like this huge ensemble, and like there was just this energy that was like it sounds kind of cheesy and like hippie-ish, but there was this energy that was being created by the people on stage, and I was addicted immediately. I'm just like that's what I want to do more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing some small like the first play I did. I was I think 6 or 7. And I tried out for The King and I at the big Fulton Opera House in downtown Lancaster. And I got cast. And my dad, who had been working there for years, he also got cast as one of the slaves. And so I was one of the little princes that you know, Anna's there to kind of teach and everything else.
Yeah.
And at a young age, I just was like, I needed to have that in my life. And so did a bunch of stuff in elementary school. I was in Witness with Harrison Ford and Kelly McGillis and Alexander Gudinov, filmed in Strasburg, Pennsylvania.
Really?
Yeah. 3 days in the god-awful August heat of Pennsylvania and humidity,
yeah.
Wearing like black wool overalls and a white cotton shirt, black hat.
What was your part?
I was an extra. I was just a little kid that was kind of running around and, you know, there's... The only scene that I can actually try and lay claim to,
yeah.
And it seems like kind of a cop-out, but it is the truth. There's a scene where during the barn raising scene, there's a bunch of little kids and they're all hammering nails into the side of this barn. And I'm pretty sure that, you know, the parents knew the day before, a couple days before, that this is what the kids were going to be doing. So the kids, you know, the parents were just like, okay, we're going to take you out back and you're going to build like a tough shed. Like you're going to, I'm going to show you how to do like the star pattern with the nails. Because all their nails were going in neat and perfect. And mine were like bent and just disheveled and like the wood splintering. I'm just like taking out some aggression. And at one point, there's this older Amish dude walking down the road, and he looks down, and he just swats one kid on the butt. That was me. That's all I can say. That from behind, being slapped on the ass, I could only say that was me. And again, like I said, sounds like a cop-out, but I've got pictures of my dad and I on sets. I've got pictures of my dad and Harrison Ford together. The most heartbreaking thing about Witness is there's a scene where they have that lunch after the barn's finally raised, and there's Harrison Ford and Kelly McGillis is behind him, and Alexander Gudinov is a couple of people over, and my dad is sitting to his immediate right. Mm-hmm. And so when they filmed it, you know, my dad was super excited. We get to the release, and we're sitting in the theater, and finally that scene comes up, and they show Harrison, and you can see Kelly, and there's a tree branch that comes down just strategically to completely obscure my dad's face. You can barely even see that there's someone sitting there. And to watch my dad's face just go from elation to complete and utter devastation was just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
For me, I mean, I'm a little kid. I could tell it blew him away.
Yeah.
You know, and so, yeah, just that. And then I got to high school. I did speech and debate and theater. And I majored in theater in college. And even as I was going along those lines, comedy was that thing that I'm just like, I like doing the ensemble thing, but I like being like a one-man show kind of thing. So,
do you have plans to do a one-man show?
Yes, tonight at The Current, you can catch me in my one-man show with a few other people opening for me. Just gotta get the people warmed up, and then there's just like 3 hours of me. I've thought about it, but I just don't. I don't know. It would be kind of dark and sad at points because you know I had to sit and watch Dad kind of die for the most part. Like mm-hmm. he got severe cancer late in life. He quit smoking cigarettes at like 65, and he had smoked like 2-3 packs a day for like 40 years.
Wow.
You know, and this is back when you could smoke in hospitals, like in the operating room, didn't matter. But yeah, when he got sick and like me having to kind of take care of him, like a lot of that really helped me define the fact that, okay, if I'm going to chase this idea or this dream of being a comic, it's not going to come and find me in my mom's attic. I got to go out and I got to grab it by the lips and just not let go.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided I was going to move from Pennsylvania to Portland because a buddy of mine lived out here. And I'm just like, I got to move as far from my safety net as possible because if I have a chance to give up, I will, and I'll just go right back home. I need to fucking go all in if I'm going to make this thing happen. So.
Yeah. So it became less of a something that you wanted to do and more of a survival.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you're here. You might as well do this or blow Asian businessmen. I mean, it's...
Hey, both paths.
That's where we met.
Working just fine, yeah.
Exactly.
Jeez, I forgot what question we were on. Jimmy, same question. Go.
What was the question?
I don't know. What question were we on? Okay, we'll move on to the next one. I like asking this one in comparison. What is your best gig ever, and what is your worst gig ever?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. I like that one.
I like something this. I for amateur comics, it gives them both warning and hope. So
certainly haven't given a lot of thought. I know that one of... This would probably be my worst gig ever. Was it was at a place in Portland that I had had success at in the past, and the show was a different structure than I was used to, just physically stage wise, and it wasn't a pack scene like I was used to, and I was going through some personal things. I tried to do my best. And after probably 5-7 minutes of just nothing, just getting nothing from the crowd, it was, you know...
Yeah.
I think that, and that's an easy tell, is like when you don't have people hating you or loving you and you're just getting nothing from them, that's where I can't stand it. And so I just kind of snapped and just very honestly, I was like, you know what, I can't do this. I can't do this right now. I'm going to leave. I don't care that I'm getting paid. I don't want to. Just let me get the hell out of here. And I just walked away.
Wow.
And then the owner of the bar was like, who I didn't know was the owner of the bar until after we spoke. I should have left that out for half a second. But the guy at the bar was like, oh, it was really funny, man. That was great. And I was like, yeah, then why was no one laughing? And he's like, oh, I was. I loved it. I'm the owner. It's like, cool. Good night.
Great for you.
Uh-huh.
Here's my email. Be happy to come back. Just let me know.
Exactly. So anytime. I walked away, and the host chased after me and gave me, you know, $25 for the show or whatever it was. And, you know, that was, okay, well, at least I, you know, didn't miss out on some cash that I desperately needed at the time. But, yeah, it felt like a bad dream.
So
it felt like a panic attack.
I had a gig just earlier this year in which a friend of mine was in ICU in a coma.
Oh, damn.
And I left the hospital to go do this gig, and the last thing that I heard was, yes, we're taking him off life support today.
Oh, God.
So I then went and did this gig, and I got a text I think the last person was on stage, got a text from my dad saying that, and I asked my friend, I asked Tony, I was like, hey, Tony, can you close out the show for me? I think I need a second here.
Uh-huh.
So, and damn, yeah, I was hosting, and I opened the show, and the only thing I could do was death jokes. I mean, it was a coping mechanism, I guess. Mm-hmm. It was just,
keep from crying almost.
Yeah, exactly. And it was, I mean, because the audience has no idea what's going on in my life.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I can do whatever jokes about whatever, and they're just like, oh, hey, these are just jokes. But to me, like, hey, these mean something to me right now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, would you like to share, like, what was happening? Like, what was making it so hard that night?
Oh, yeah. I had recently got put in jail for a night. It was for contempt of court for missing a child support hearing. And I was basically, like, very depressed at the time anyways and was, like, feeling damn near suicidal. And yeah, then I got a call from a cop that was like, hey, got your warrant here. Let's go. And I was just like, all right, what can I do about this? Turn yourself in. That's pretty much it. And I was just like, great. All right, bye.
Officer Frank and Honest here on the phone.
Yeah, he was not nice. So I'd spent like, and the thing is too, it was to make it worse is that I was calling people when I was feeling suicidal and before I went to jail, and one of the people I turned to was my mom, and she helped pull me out of it. But she also made me promise that when I go to jail, that I will tell them that I've been thinking about killing myself. And so I promised my mother this, and so I did it. And because of that, they put me in basically isolation for 36 hours, naked, wearing a suicide smock.
Wow.
And this was for being too broke. this is all for being too poor.
They took my clothes.
Yeah, so I got treated really poorly and was just kind of stuck there and had to wait it out.
I'd say the worst part of that, just from my standpoint, is you didn't even get a chance to beat someone's ass on the first day to establish dominance.
Yeah,
exactly. Like,
they just sent you to isolation.
But at least they know I'm crazy enough to kill myself in a heartbeat, apparently.
I like me. I'll nothing. Kill me. You don't even want to know what I'll do to you.
Exactly.
You've got your own private room, so I'm looking for the downside in all of this.
Yeah, it was a... I remember doing that, too. Like, as the room was so small, I was, like, trying to, make the best of a bad situation. I was like, well, this is just like having an apartment in New York. I can make believe for a little bit.
No TV, no furniture, cramped spaces. Yeah.
Approximately 40 square feet. So I was recently out of jail and wondering what was going to happen next. And it was funny, too, because I was really trying to make, like, a bold effort in all of my sets and just getting nothing at the time. It's kind of crushing for like a week or two.
Wow. Is that your only time in jail?
It's my only time more than 4 hours in jail. I went to jail another time. They're like, we're letting you go. No pressure to be in charge. Cool, later.
What was that for?
That was for interrupting a police call.
What? Yeah.
My
did you like unplug the phone or something?
Yeah, my ex-girlfriend's sister was upset that I was there because she wanted to stay in that place, and I was staying with my girlfriend, and so she wanted me out, and so she started to call the cops, and I went to grab the phone, and that was why I went to jail.
Because you grabbed a phone?
Yeah, because I tried to keep someone from making a call to the police. And yeah, so all charges got dropped, and I got let out that night.
I don't know how many times my parents had to stop me from dialing 911 when I was a kid. Because in first grade, you learn, hey, if there's, something's going on, dial 911.
Uh-huh.
So I just get bored. I'm like, oh, that's right. I can dial 911 whenever I want.
What's your emergency? We are out of cookies. We have no... I've checked every cupboard. I have checked the jar. There's no cookies.
There's
here.
Nothing on TV.
Yeah. This is for emergencies only. Yeah, no, did you hear me? No,
no
Thundercats.
Not a single cookie.
I'd watch a GoBots rerun right now. That's how desperate I am for a goddamn cartoon.
It's just Oprah. That's it.
God.
Oprah and infomercials. Soap opera. Oh,
I don't like TV. Santa Barbara, okay?
So.
I'll go worst.
Well, no, first I have to ask if you've ever been to jail.
No, sadly.
That's a subject wrong.
Sadly. Yeah, no, sadly. I've never lived a life that exciting at all. Like, for the longest time, like, one of my biggest fears is going to prison and being naked in public. And those two things, like, kind of come together when you go to prison.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I've never been I've never even been, like, cuffed. Well, against my will.
Yeah.
I've never been handcuffed. There's usually a safe word involved. It's always, Kentucky. But, yeah, so aside from that, just nothing really that kind of dangerous, live a boring life. But my worst gig, I would say, has to be the Mount Hood Dinner Train.
Oh.
And so here in the Pacific Northwest, there's a lot of beautiful countryside. And one way to enjoy that is to take the Mount Hood Dinner Train. Mount Hood's one of the big mountains that we have around here. And how that goes down is you meet at this, little secluded train stop, and you and your party get on this train. You've got big windows everywhere, and you go through the scenery, and they serve you dinner and dessert. And then for entertainment, they have comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get three comics. You do 15 minutes in one car. There's three cars. So everybody's in a car. You do your 15 minutes. You switch. do another 50 minutes, then you do the last car, and then you do basically 45 minutes worth of material. They pay you $100.
Yeah.
So this, like, I was a young comic. I was super stoked. I had a solid 15 or so, I thought. You know, I'm like, this is perfect. So we drive up and meet the train at this one stop. It's like on the last leg of the whole tour for that night. Mm. And we get on the train and discover that it's a loggers convention that's there. So it's almost all loggers. And they've been the lords have a temper and they've been drinking all day kind of a thing. So they were fucking pretty soused. And we get there. We discover that there are no mics. There is no stage. There isn't even a stage. You're performing in the foot and a half wide space between the seats that the bus staff and the wait staff are trying to remove plates and put out like coffee and desserts for people.
So you're roughly getting paid to do the same thing that bums do in the New York subway.
In a sense, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But making less money for it.
Clearly.
Yeah, clearly. Probably, yeah.
You know, and so, the train's in motion. Mm-hmm. So your stage is constantly rocking back and forth. And, you know, you're trying to get out of people's way because they're trying to get past you.
Yeah.
You're basically making a scene in a train, yelling at both ends. And at one point, a guy stood up and said, I will pay you $50 cash if I can throw you off this train right now. And I'm like, let me see the money. Because I'm a durable son of a bitch. I will take your money if you will, you know, because I mean, $150.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they're like, tell some political jokes. I'm like, and of course, I've got no political humor, you know. And so, and I was following this guy called the Mustard Man. Through all the different rooms.
A professional.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Mark Kinkle, a.k.a. the Mustard Man. That's what he used to go by anyway. And, like, he's got, like, long hippie hair and, like, a beard. And he's wearing, like, tie-dye shirt and, like, mustard yellow sweatpants.
Oh, God.
You know, and I hear him in the next car, and he is slaying mercilessly. And I couldn't borrow a laugh.
God.
And he's doing, like, every room I would go in after him, everyone's got, like, balloon animals. You know, like, I think he painted a couple people's faces. Like, what did I miss? What is it that this guy's bringing to the table that I clearly lack? And so the last train car that we were in, there was a couple that were, like, they were sitting on opposite sides of each other, facing each other at the table. And they're both laying down on their sides on the seats. And I walk over and I'm just like, I'm sorry, are you just guys just not enjoying the show? They're like, no, this is our first date. We both have motion sickness. And I'm like, oh, God. Oh, I'm like, I'm so sorry. She's like, just please stop talking.
Oh, God.
I can't. They're paying me to talk.
I have another 14 and a half minutes. I'm so sorry. God. I'll try and talk very quickly. So, yeah, we got done with our sets, and they let us drink for free, and so we got to their destination. And so it was me, my buddy Dan Cassette, and the Mustard Man. And the three of us just got shit hammered.
Yeah.
And the bar car.
That's your only option.
You know, and we get off, and people are, you know, detraining, and we're just like, hey, thanks for coming, everybody. This is a great time or whatever. And, God, I used to keep, they gave us a check, and I kept the pay stub in my wallet for years. Because I get done with the show, and he's like, oh, that just sucked. And I reach into my wallet, and I pull out that stub, and I'm like, but it wasn't the goddamn Mount Hood dinner train. That much I know for true.
Yeah.
So I don't even know if they still do it, but if they paid me $1 million, absolutely no fucking way in hell would I ever do another train.
$1 million?
Yeah, $1 million.
Yeah, but see, if I'm pretty sure for $1 million, you would strip naked and just walk back and forth through the train for an hour.
Yeah, I wouldn't have to talk, though. I would just have to walk back and forth naked, you know, and, you know, they'd be blinded by their own vomit. So, I mean, that's kind of a twofer for me. But yeah, that was hands down the worst show, without doubt.
Yeah. The story that I told last night, if you guys were listening, that was my worst. I hope that I can go the rest of my career and say that was my worst gig ever.
Yeah. Yes. Well, the thing is, as soon as you affix that, you're kind of setting yourself up for failure because something else is going to come along.
Yeah.
You kind of, like, as a comic, you just have to realize those shows are going to happen. Those kicks to the balls are going to be a reality.
Yeah.
You can either let them beat you. Mm-hmm. Or you can stand up and say, no, I will be better than this moment in my life, and I will rise again, sir. I will not go quietly into that dark night, okay? I am Bill Pullman. This is my Independence Day. Welcome to Earth, bitch.
Lone Star.
President Lone Star had this to say.
So, okay, so what is your best gig ever?
Last night at KO's. Hands down, they carried me out like Rudy at the end, where they just, you know. Best show ever? I would say when I was still on KUFO, we had the opportunity to interview David Alan Greer in studio. Wow. He was in town. He was doing a show at the Aladdin Theater. And the host of the show that I was doing at the time was supposed to come in early to interview David Alan Greer, and for whatever reason, he just didn't want to, you know. And so they decided to give it to the afternoon guy, this guy named Bozic, who's really awesome. And so Dan comes to me and just like, yeah. So they gave me the David Alan Greer interview. Do you want to sit in with me and hang out? Because you're a comic, he's a comic. You know, I can do really good interviews, but yeah, I think you'd have a kinship better.
Yeah.
And so the three of us sat in the studio, and I could tell he was just real jet-lagged and really tired. You know, and so the first part of the interview was kind of slow-moving, but once we kind of hit a groove, and just it was just so much fun.
Yeah.
And so out of nowhere, Dan's like, so David, what's about my boy Jim here? Like, you going to give him some stage time tonight? Maybe let him emcee the show? And, like, it was one of those moments where you're simultaneously, what the fuck did you do that for? Yeah. And like, oh, my God, please say yes. And so David's just like, well, I don't know this guy. I mean, he's pretty funny, but I have never actually seen him perform. You know, he could be like a Klan member or something. I don't know. I'm just saying, I only like moonlight doing some Klan work. I mean, it's good. It's like corporate the money.
Klan reserve. Yeah. You know, like 1 weekend a month.
2 weeks a year. Yeah. It's they're barely racist. They're racial curious.
Just for the money, right? Just to say that you served.
So, so he's like, okay, I'm going to do a thing on the air. He's like, I'm going to do an intro for you, and then you just, like, start doing your thing. And I'm like, okay. And inside, I am freaking the fuck out, because this is terrestrial radio.
Oh, yeah.
I use a lot of swear words. So I still have this recorded somewhere, and it's David Alan Greer, and he's just like, ladies and gentlemen, next comic coming on the stage, one of my favorite comedians ever, funniest black comic around, get up for Big Jim. Oh. And so he starts beatboxing my intro song, and I don't even remember what I said for the most part. And got him laughing, and after the show, he's just like, yeah, come down to the Aladdin, I'll let you emcee the show. And I'm like, are you serious?
Wow.
So I got to go, and the thing was, I was so disoriented, because everything was kind of getting thrown at me at the very last minute. And so, but I got to go out on the Aladdin stage, and like the audience there, when you do a club versus doing like a bar or like a smaller venue, the clubs are so much easier, because the people are there to laugh. They're paying money. Yeah. They want to laugh.
Oh, yeah.
So your job is that much easier. But just to be in that moment and know that I get to bring up one of my idols from the Living Color days. And this was right before Chocolate News was going to hit. I didn't realize how much I was going to love that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was, without doubt, I'd say one of my best shows ever that I've done.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty crazy. I mean, to just have it work, like, I can understand, like, all of the, you know, planets aligning to make that happen.
Totally, yeah.
Is just ridiculous. Luckiest man in the world.
I had him autograph one of the posters for the moment, and he had forgotten that my name was Jim, and he wrote, you know, thanks for the work, real funny stuff tonight, Big Tim, have a great time, David Alan Greer. And I looked at that, and I'm like, you have to change my name to Jim now. As Dag said, it's Tim, so it's got to be Tim now. That's how it has to be.
Yeah, Big Tim. I mean, a T into a J. It's not. Did you try to correct it afterwards?
I was thinking about it. I'm just like, nah, that'd be like desecrating like a holy artifact in my mind. I'm like, I couldn't do that. I just, you know.
Because people are. Because
I'd still know in my heart of hearts that he thinks my name is Tim.
Yeah, but now. But to you, you look at that poster and it means something to you. But when everybody else in the world looks at it, to them, it means that you bought it off of eBay.
Yeah, from some guy named Big Tim.
Yeah, exactly. So
we used to remember the Big Network. We all kind of hang out. There's Big Mark, Big Sam.
Yeah.
You know, Big Scott.
Big Al. Yeah.
Big Al.
Yeah. Exactly. Jimmy, best gig ever. And you can't say KOs. He already said that.
Sure. I got two examples. I'll make them both quick. One was the show where I was brought in. They asked me to do a sketch for the show. And I was like, great. So I happened to be there waiting to do the sketch. They had two comics drop out of the show. But even though they had two comics drop out of the show and I was still there, they didn't want to put me up. And I don't know for what reason. I think they thought that I wasn't funny, which was frustrating because I knew I was. And you know, maybe it was there like, oh, this sketch has so much credibility, you know, everyone's going to believe that you're a cop in this sketch. Don't want to spoil the mystique of theater with you doing a stand-up set and destroying the fourth wall.
The Dennis Franz of comedy.
Kicking the fourth wall until it can't breathe anymore. You fraud. So at any rate, like, before, finally, at some point during the show or before the show started, they're like, can you do 3 to 5 minutes? And I was like, I'm going to fucking destroy.
And that was the show in the mouth.
Yeah, and that was like the one time I knew I was going to kill, and I did. And they were like so thankful and so grateful and really pleased, gave me compliments. I had a great set. I had the world's worst threesome after that set. So it was
bittersweet.
Memorable night. And then the other time that is a tie for that one, it's at this place called The Tanker, which always has like kind of like a running Bridgetown Comics open mic for Bridgetown performers. And it's like really hard to get people's attention there. You have to be like a superstar or have something, you know, really original that no one's ever heard before. And so I got time there and I was feeling pretty great. And I went up and I did, you know, whatever, like probably the 5 or 6 minute version of this There Will Be Blood Daniel Plainview bit I have. And everybody shut up. They all listened. They all laughed. They all, you know, applauded. Basically just, you know, destroyed the room after. And I heard after I'd done it that everyone had talked through everyone that night and that nobody paid any attention to anyone. And I was the first one. Wow. And then later, I found out from these two just really adorable, really sweet, so much younger than me.
Chinese
girls. They came up to me at a show at a later date and told me, like, that time that you were at the Tanker, okay, we're roommates. We're best friends. There Will Be Blood is our favorite movie.
Wow.
We happened to be at the Tanker that night. We were both doing acid for the first time in our lives.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, this is cosmic. Like, I was meant to be there that night. This is amazing. And
can you imagine how... because. You've done acid before, a time or two.
Yeah,
12,
and like with my closest friends too. Yeah. So it was to got what they're talking about.
Like I for one can't handle like, you know, crowded rooms like that because I just there's just too right? much thing. I shit overload.
Oh, brave, awesome women! I
and
love
you.
Them
come up like a prophet. Yeah, like you'd like a staff and like long glowing gray hair. You know, like Gandalf the Awesome. You know, and you lay down this, and they're just like, "There's no way he's talking about what we." And, like, you probably anchored them back to reality a little bit.
Yeah, by something they recognize, right? Yeah. It was cool.
Or maybe they thought they were hallucinating so bad that they thought that just all of a sudden you started doing that scene.
It's possible, too, because the only other time I ever talked to them, they came out to a show where I didn't do any There Will Be Blood material. Yeah. So they're...
We thought that you were... Nope, it's done.
What are you talking about? No, yeah. I never did that.
Never did that once. Did not base any of my act on it.
They were convinced that Daniel Day-Lewis did comedy one time with a Tanker.
Exactly.
Just slayed it. Just slayed it.
Yep.
So, you already said David Alan Greer.
Yeah.
Big name that you've worked with. Have you worked with any big names, Jimmy?
Big Jim. Biggest name in comedy.
Thank you. Thank you.
I've worked with... I've worked with a few people. I guess. I mean, it's not... But I mean, like... See, like, I've never, like, opened for somebody in that regard. Like, it's always just these, you know, shows that I happen to be put on that the person that's the headliner had no choice. You know? Like, you know, so it's like, to say that I worked with them is a bit of a stretch, but I have done comedy on shows with my personal hero of life, Maria Bamford.
Ooh, right on.
And, another big hero of life, Kyle Kinane.
Wow.
And, those were probably my favorites, for sure.
Those are two really good comics.
Seriously.
Yeah,
and to make them laugh is a gift from the heavens.
And you've done Bridgetown how many times?
Five.
Son of really? A bitch.
Wow.
It doesn't mean anything, because they still don't know who I am. Even within the festival that I've done five straight years, last year they put me on the Bridgetown Newcomer Show.
Wow. So they may have thought it should have been Newstetter show. Like you should have been like the chief star, but they're just like nah, newcomer.
Yeah, I'm the most forgotten about comedy person in Portland. I think.
I would say that. Would you rather be maybe overlooked but continuously booked back, Or like in my situation where I did like the very first year.
Right.
And since then I couldn't, and I helped Andy and Matt make that Bridgetown thing happen. I helped them promote shows before they had Bridgetown even on the books. And then once they did Bridgetown, had them on the show that I was the producer for to help raise awareness. And that's like that first year I got on. Then after that, and even that was like, I was supposed to MC one of the shows at the Hawthorne Theater. And I show up there, and there's already some other guy there, and he's MCing, and I'm just like, so hold on. So I call Andy. He's like, oh, yeah, there was a snafu. I don't know. You can go do this show if you want. So it was kind of like a cursory, kind of like a, I'll toss you this bone if you like it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but again, you can't become resentful in that capacity. You just kind of got to understand that sometimes that happens, you know, and if you think you're as big a name that deserves special treatment, 9 times out of 10, you're gonna shoot yourself in the foot and lose more gigs than you'll get.
Yeah, aye, it is true.
Aye.
So what? I don't know who. You don't have to name any names, but I mean, what is the most difficult booker or comedian that you've ever worked with?
Hmm.
How did you handle the situation?
His name rhymes with Tony G. And I didn't want to say it. I didn't want to say it out loud. We were all thinking it. We were all thinking it really hard.
Macaroni fee.
I'm trying to think. Most difficult.
I'm the difficult one. Yes. Everyone's easy to work with comparatively.
Timmy Neustetter was a guy that hung himself on stage, actually.
Oh, God.
Very tragically.
Yeah, yeah.
He made a noose of the mic cord and just jumped into the audience. I don't know. I've been blessed in the fact that not too many of the people that I've... even like the larger of the names... have been very gracious and very respectful of the fact that, yes, they are where they are. We see them from one standpoint. They see themselves from a different standpoint. They see where they want to be, obviously, still on the horizon.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting kind of... And I've seen that through various people. I've seen that juxtaposition where you're like, you look up to somebody, and then somebody comes over to you as a comic, and they kind of have that same like starry-eyed fanboyness to them, and you're just like... Why are you wasting your awe on me?
Yeah.
Like, I am the buzzing of flies to the likes of these other people.
Yeah.
You know, but I hope to keep that humility about me as well.
Mm-hmm.
When I get to a point where I can say that I have that kind of pull or that kind of, you know, weight.
Yeah. See, I'm, with my personality, I'm deathly afraid that once I get a fan, that I'm going to pull some sort of Lenny from Mice and Men, and...
I will pet him, I love him.
And just, I'm going to smother this first fan that I get, and I will become their stalker. Like, you love me! You love me!
Doing a show tonight, want to come? I'll give you a ride.
Yeah, hey, yeah, you want to go? I can get you in, it'll be awesome.
I'll just do time now.
Yeah, just do it here. You have a living room, right? I'll just go back to your place? Yeah, that'll totally work. And so, wait, do you guys go out to shows and have people go there just specifically to see you?
I have on occasion, especially back in the radio days, because people were listening like 5 days a week. So I would have people that were like, you know, you don't realize it at the time because it's sort of like comedy in the fact that you're detached from the audience. You're just kind of talking to a microphone, not realizing just how many people are listening. And so... they'd come up to you after the show and be like, oh, my God, you know, huge fan. I'm just like, dude.
Yeah.
You know, I shat myself 3 weeks ago. Do you ever know that? I mean, that's, how's that for a god, right?
You're like me.
Jimmy, how about you?
No, I usually find out after the fact on a show that I bailed on.
Oh.
They'll be like, I only went there to see you. Shouldn't have trusted me.
Sorry. Hitchhiked, 3 states. Yeah, thanks for nothing, Neustetter.
Sold my kidney to get home.
Yeah.
No, I would...
You owe me a kidney?
Missed my mom's funeral. Thanks, Jimmy. Really, that was great. Needed to laugh, Jimmy. Where were you?
It's happened... Oh, well, I guess it has happened once, and it ended very well.
Well, good. So, as long as you've been doing this, how... Okay, and this is... I love this question. As you've been doing this, how has your definition of success evolved? And where are you now in comparison to that.
That's funny. Or I like that one.
Yeah.
Do you want to feel that
No,
one?
Go for it.
Okay. Let's see here. My definition of success, I started off like with the lowest of expectations. Mm-hmm. Like, I, you know, growing up, I'd go to like a lot of parties and people were like, dude, you should do comedy. You're funny and everything else. And that's kind of where it started for me. And it was something that I'd emulated a lot. I'd always wanted to try legitimately and just kind of like make it sort of like a cursory here or there kind of a stab at it, you know, and be consistent and get, you know, get in with that whole thing. And so once I achieved that, I'm like, okay, well now you're here. Now what?
Mm-hmm.
And so, okay, well, I want to start working on the road. I want to start making money at this. And, you know, I thought that if you were consistently funny, that you were a professional comedian. That's mm-hmm. not true. My definition of a professional comedian is somebody that makes all of their money, pays all of their bills by doing comedy. Yeah. Because that is, in fact, your profession.
Yeah.
So, where I wanted to be at one point was I wanted to do, like, movies and stuff like that, kind of like along the Adam Sandler role. And then, I don't know when it happened, but now, like, my current dream job would be game show host.
Really?
Really. Like, you get to meet new people every day. Mm-hmm. You get to make a couple people really happy by giving them a lot of money.
Yeah.
And you just get to be funny and have, you know, have a good time doing it. So yeah. And you get paid scads of money.
Yeah.
So, I mean, why wouldn't you want to do that? And you work for like a half hour at a time.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Success.
Success.
Well, let's go back here. Where are you in relation to your now definition?
It was weird because I kind of drifted away from the comedy scene for a while, and then I kind of drifted back, and it's hard to kind of rebuild momentum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the only good side of that is that the comedy scene in Portland has expanded so much during my absence that now I get to kind of reintroduce myself to a bunch of people that don't know who I was or for the most part, anything mm-hmm. that I've achieved. So I get to kind of clean slate it a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I'm starting to move forward slowly now, but... definitely have the wisdom from before to kind of help guide me into the future.
So when was this lapse in laughs?
It started like I think right around like when I started getting in with the radio heavy. I just didn't have time to do it, and then after I got out of the radio, I just didn't want to have people ask me, "So what happened?" So I kind of like let it drift away for an even longer period of time, and then I started doing the podcast with Don, and from there got back into doing comedy slowly over time, and started going to more and more mics. And just remembering, again, how much you love doing it. Because once you've done it once and had fun doing it, there's no drug, there's no booze, there's no sex that can compare to that feeling of having a room full of people's, you know, attention in the palm of your hand. You get to mold it any way you want.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's a good feeling.
Yeah, hands down.
Gets you back into it. All right, Jimmy.
When I first started, I think my basis for success, to be honest, like, I've always thought, like, I would make a good sketch writer, performer,
mm-hmm.
you know, something along those lines. So I guess, like, ideally, that would be the goal, is, like, have your own show, write and perform sketch comedy, and people pay you to do it.
Yeah.
But, like, that is still my main goal, and always kind of has been, is just write and perform sketch comedy. But, like, as far as my personal goals within comedy, like, that are more short term, it's all I really care about is being like a likable person outside of like on stage, you know what I mean, so that people will want to have me on their shows and want to travel with me and whatnot. Like, I just want to, because I'm such a bad drunk and I'm such a heckler, like I'm the helping heckler when I go out to an open mic. Everybody loves when I talk back. And sometimes it is funny.
Me too. I'm the same guy.
Most time it's super obnoxious. So I'm like, I can't go out to open mics. I'll just get drunk. I'll just spend money. I'll just be a fucking asshole. So all I really want to do is just have people go like, "Oh, I like Jimmy. I want him on my show." And that's my what I want now is I don't want to do open mics, that I still want to do comedy.
Yeah.
That's my level of success at the moment.
No, I gotcha.
It's like I enjoy open mics, but I just don't have the income to, and like the whatchamacallit, the
liver fortitude.
You're right. And just the like the punishment, you know, like 4 or 5 hours out of my night to wait.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like just getting a line for a living.
You know, and it's to be fair, like the open mic is like the gym. You go there to work on your talent to strengthen your comedy muscle, and everything else. But you're not a focus. You are like anybody else at the gym. You're just there. You're working on your stuff.
Yeah.
You know, you get your reaction, and then you're gone. And then the audience could really, you know, you just sort of disappear into their short-term memory.
Yeah.
You know, but when you go out on the road and you have a great show, like that feeling that you get is just incredible, and it's like therapy, and it just sort of heals so many shitty days that you've had leading up to that point. So, based on the fact that, you know, open mics are good for what they're there for, but if that's like your only thing, you're basically working out for a fight that you never get to compete in.
Yeah,
that's true. And I got to make clear, too, like, I see the importance of open mics. You have to get on stage. You have to repeat the same stuff all the time because you want to be yourself on stage, and that's why people do the same material and over again, is so that their personality comes out of the jokes instead of the other way around. But at the same time, like, open mics in Portland have gotten much more difficult to be on. Like, it's not like a simple go and show up and get on process anymore. It's like you have to sign up with someone the day before. You have to sign up with someone on email. You have to go to a place, sign up, wait an hour, come back, check and see if you're on it, and then go home sad. It's there's not open mics anymore, you know, not in the sense of, like, comedy has gotten so huge, like 300 different stand-up comics in Portland, that doing an open mic is not a simple thing. And considering that I did put in the 5 years to make myself more established in Portland, I don't want to jump through hoops to do open mic comedy. Is a bigger part of it for me, too.
Yeah, when Jimmy and I kind of first started, there was only, like, what, 30, 40 comics, maybe tops?
Yeah, I would say that's Portland. Accurate.
And I'd say of that 40... maybe a third kind of just dropped off or just went off and did their own thing, or maybe just moved away.
Yeah.
And then over time, like with Bridgetown and Portlandia coming to town and bringing just more and more heat to the city, more and more people are getting motivated and literally moving to Portland to be a part of that whole scene. And so now it's just so oversaturated that trying to stand out in any way, that used to be the beauty of Portland, is you could stand out easily if you were, you know, consistent and funny.
Yeah.
Now you got to, it's almost cliquish.
Yeah.
Try and break in.
You got to have a show.
That sucks.
It's cultish. Yep.
Yeah. So let's burn Portland to the ground.
Fucking
fuck
hipster.
It. Just do it. We'll all move to Bend. Jimmy and I will be the mayors, as we were talking about.
You either have to
night.
Be the nicest person in the world or really be able to fake it.
Yeah.
I can't do either.
And see, I think that the story that I told about doing the retirement center, comedy at the retirement center for the 20th. So, yeah, the only other audience...
Take me now, sweet angel of death.
Yeah, exactly. And see, on that one, I didn't blame the audience. I was not prepared
Russian
for that.
Russian roulette again?
My masturbation jokes were not a good part of that. but... So
the last erection I got was during World War II when I put my bayonet through the face of a young lad.
Huh. Anyway,
true story, but
no. So I mean, the old folks, half of them were trying to pretend that they couldn't see me there, and the other ones actually couldn't see me there. So I didn't blame the audience there, but the only time I've ever actually blamed the audience was when I did an open mic in Eugene, and the entire crowd looked exactly the same in their skinny jeans, GI glasses, and crappy haircuts. And what kills me is that I went up there and started doing it, and people weren't even, like, trying to laugh or get into it just because I was not dressed like them. They decided that that I was not funny before
Eugene?
I even said anything. I know,
really?
Right? It's weird that they would do
what?
Something like that, yeah.
I am not going to sit here and listen to this slander.
Yeah, I know.
This is...
So... Yeah, that I have no desire to go back to. And here's the best part is my girlfriend just moved to Eugene, and I wanted to go with her, but I just can't do comedy in Eugene. I just can't. It's
so you broke up. Good move.
Hipsters.
Strong move.
Yeah, exactly. I had to choose between the love of my life or my girlfriend, and I chose comedy.
And I stand by my decision.
Yeah, exactly. So
made that decision like 3 or 4 times over at this point. Completely willingly.
Comedy, you better pay off at this point. I've gone all in too many times.
Yeah. Well,
breaking a mirror every day.
When I was doing the business side of comedy, I had my own comedy club for a while, and I was doing booking and putting on shows and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
That was no big deal. That was work. That was just business.
But then once I started actually doing stand-up comedy, I had to explain to my girlfriend that, now this is probably the best thing I've ever heard, is that comedy, doing stand-up comedy is a relationship.
Yeah.
So if you are going to have a relationship with a significant other while doing comedy, they need to understand that you are now in a polygamy-type relationship. It is now a three-way, and if you have to understand that, you have to give that leeway. And I'm both of you guys are single, is that right?
No, I've got a girl that I've been with for, I'd say, about 3 years now.
Oh, okay.
We're flirting with 3 years at this point.
And how does she handle it?
Amazingly well. Well, I guess it's still kind of relatively early on in the relationship. but not just with comedy, but also with, the podcast. Because three nights a week, I go over to Don's house, and we usually do go late night. So I'll, tuck her in, and then go and do the podcast, and so she has to kind of go to bed alone.
Yeah.
And so that sort of stuff puts a strain on a relationship. But she's seen me perform, and she believes in, my talents, and she supports me both, emotionally and comedically. And, there's no... I couldn't ask for anything more than that, The girlfriend that I had before that for 7 years, was so much of an introvert... extroverts, the one that doesn't like to go out and hang out with people.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah. She came out a little bit here and there, but after a while it was just it was you're still doing that thing kind of approach to it. And so I'm just very lucky with the fact that she acknowledges the fact that this is something that I'm very passionate about. And, she knows that she can't ever say it's either comedy or me.
Yeah.
Because, she gonna lose that contest. And so she knows not to ask that sort of thing. And, it is very tough because you've got, moments like this where, you're away for a couple of days. Maybe you're away for a week or 2 weeks. The bigger you get, the more into comedy you get, the more widow or widower, depending on if you're a male or female comic, your other relationship becomes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you're successful on the road, you're making decent money, but you're a stranger in your own house, so to speak. And so that's something else that you really kind of got to be prepared for if comedy is something that you want to do. Comedy or music or any kind of entertainment, you either leave your family behind or you bring them with you, which is a great idea. It's so much fun. You're just around each other all the fucking time.
So she puts up with your comedy career, but how involved does she get?
She's helped me write a couple jokes in that, that whole farting on her thing was something that actually happened. And a couple other things that have sort of gone on in our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
She has been a direct inspiration for whatever, and she gives me ideas, and she does that thing that everybody does. And as a comic, you just kind of got to learn to smile and eat it. And so, you should use it as a bit in your comedy. I just helped you.
Yeah.
You're a better person. You're a better comic for having known me. Aren't you happy and thankful?
Yeah.
And you just going to be like, yeah, no, I'm totally going to do that. I'm writing it down right now. Here's the pen on the paper. There you go.
Yeah.
So, she'll do that on occasion. But, for the most part, she just kind of steps back a little bit. For a time, I was thinking about maybe just making her my manager because she's so much more put together and professional than I am. I got to call a booker. I got to call him back. We can't just, fuck, all right. I'm going to make some money or whatever, I guess. She's got her big girl pants on, and I'm just kind of, slapdicking it around over here. So,
which is pretty much how it goes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Without doubt.
Jimmy, single?
I have someone in my life. It's a bit complicated.
But is it Jesus?
It's Jesus. Long, gorgeous, flowing hair.
Mm.
Swimmer's body.
Swimmer's body, yeah.
Yep. Great listener. Great listener. Yeah. Great.
But,
put my hands together like this.
She's parent supportive level of support. She believes in me. If I want to do comedy, she's like, go for it. Go all in. If I don't want to do comedy, she's like, yeah, it's fine. You'll find something better. So it's been pretty great.
I'll prove you wrong.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. So does she get involved?
No, and other than just being, supportive, just 110%. Yeah.
Well, that's good. Yeah.
There was a wake for one of the comedians in Portland that committed suicide, and both my girlfriend and I knew him, and so they had this kind of a celebration of his life thing in Portland a couple of months back, and it was a bunch of comics got up there and we did our material and said our respects to the family and the friends and everybody else, and it was really cool. You know, his mom and his family were there. And at the end, they said if anybody, either comic or non-comic, just has a Brady story that they want to tell, by all means, come up on stage. And so most of the people that were there were like, eh, if I got a story, I don't want to tell it in front of a bunch of people.
Yeah.
So a bunch of comics got back up there. I got back up there. And then my girlfriend came up, and she told, like, two Brady stories and just killed it.
Really?
Just slayed the room. Wow. And, like, she had good timing and presence and everything else. Yeah. I'm just like, fuck you, bitch. I didn't go to college and graduate twice like you did. Stay out of my world.
So, but I did go to college twice. Yeah. So, yeah.
To buy weed.
And then security found out, so I was never allowed back.
Yeah, I can't go back to
yeah.
that.
Yeah. So now I have to go just to the corner of campus and wait for a guy.
Hey, steak knife. Oh, you're going to class? Okay, cool. I'll catch you.
I'll just be right here. I'll just be right here. I got nothing to do. Nothing to do today.
Take care of you.
So, yeah, I mean, the least that you can ask from a significant other is just general support.
Yeah.
I mean, even if that is only them not getting in your way, almost.
Yeah, and sometimes that's the hardest thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, if they can be, if whatever they are doing for you in a positive way and be happy about it, then I think a comic can have a successful relationship with someone.
Oh, yeah.
Have you guys ever, okay, here's a question. Have you ever dated a comic?
No. No, thank God.
Because you've never tried, or because you know that would be a horrible idea?
There was only like a brief window when I wasn't dating someone and I was still doing comedy. So I don't know. I just feel like that, you know, it would take a special situation for that to work, because it would just be like, yeah. You know, sex would take forever now because you're both doing improv work. You know, a little crowd work before you start the foreplay and everything else. Yeah. Like, so here's from out of town.
Yeah.
Know? Kind of a thing. So I don't know. I just would seem almost incestuous, I think, to me. I mean, that's just me, though. I mean, I'm not speaking for all of the comedy community.
No, I can understand how you could define it that way.
Yeah.
It's a workplace thing.
True, yeah. You don't fuck where you eat.
Yeah, exactly.
Or you shouldn't.
Yes. unless it's your fetish, in which case, knock yourself out. Yeah, exactly.
Cakefarts.com.
I'm sorry. If you've never had sex in a McDonald's bathroom, you are missing out, all right?
Hey, I'm loving it.
Yeah.
Personally. See what I did there?
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
You know, and also, you derive a lot of material from the relationships that you're in.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be somebody else's joke. Yeah. That seems kind of one-sided and prickish, but it's the truth.
Yeah. Well, and then everybody who knows you, like, after you break up and she starts telling jokes about an ex-boyfriend, Everybody just assumes that it's you.
Of course.
So, yeah, if it's a new joke after your relationship, which, yeah, I guess that would suck in the long run.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so, have you ever dated a comic?
Yes, I have dated a couple.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Obviously went well.
No, not terribly.
All right, so, next question. So, I mean, did the pretty much the same problem in each one?
No, I think it was just the one person, the first comic that I dated, we were a bit volatile as a couple. And so it didn't work out.
Mm-hmm.
And the second comic that I dated, I could tell that we had the potential to maybe be volatile as a couple. And I didn't want to get into another relationship where it was just lots of arguments.
Yeah.
Or maybe I was just on edge and didn't. I don't know, whatever, but yeah, so they ended amiably. I'm still friends with both.
Yeah.
Even though there's been, you know, not nice feelings on their end towards me, which I understand, but...
Yeah, and see, that's the thing, is that when it comes to dating other comics, out of all of the types of relationships there are in the world, I feel that when comics date, they have the best post-relationship.
Yeah, maybe it's possible, and that's probably also part of because, you know, that you're going to get a bad name in several comedy circles.
Yeah.
So better keep up that good vibes if you can.
Yeah. So, Big.
Yes.
Tell us about your podcast.
It is the Big and Loud Podcast, which can be found at thebigandloudpodcast.com. It features myself and fellow comedian Don Frost, who will also be coming down here to Bend to do the
get him on the podcast
thing. Yeah, and
also down with the clown.
Yeah, we literally no. He is a fan of the ICP, and that just drives me fucking up a wall. Because it's just like, I respect you as a human. How the fuck are you gonna just, you know? but yeah, that kind of started about I don't know, maybe a year and a half ago, and somebody had suggested that we just kind of do a podcast, and so we went and bought a bunch of equipment and sat down and kind of batted it around for a minute, and then just realized him and I just yelling at each other in his garage was funny to some people, so it just seems to have grown and grown and grown, so more good times on the horizon.
For listeners that are wondering what it's all about, like, is there a theme through the podcast?
No, it is all just stream of consciousness, free form, like, it just starts with us talking, like, but we used to do a thing where I would actually enter, like, hey, what's going on, y'all? You're listening to the Big and Loud podcast. With me, as always, is the ever dapper Don Frost, and he would find some adjective to throw back at me, and then we would start. Now, like, we're almost at 300 shows.
We just
don't give a fuck anymore. Yeah. It's just, like, hit record, and, like, we just start going. And maybe we'll write some topics down, or maybe it's just, like, we almost always talk about food. Like, every goddamn show somehow gets revolved around food and, like, our strong loves and likes or dislikes. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so I'm like, if we ever decide to stop doing, like, a comedy podcast, we could clearly move seamlessly into a cooking show of some sort.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you could do, what was it? Doug Benson has his podcast, and then he did Dining with Doug and Karen.
Yeah.
So he literally does a podcast where he sits and eats. So it can be done. Apparently, it can be done. But yeah, he has followers. He has
fucking
listeners.
Hack. Jesus, leave me something. All right, that's all I'm asking, Doug. Okay, you've taken so very much from me, and I feel
specifically you. He sucked you out.
Just you, Doug. Yeah. What's the beef? What's the beef, bro?
What the hell?
I would say when I was still on with KUFO, they got rid of the guy that I was producing for. And kind of gave me my own time slot for a while. And so I was just, like, amazed. And anytime there was a big name coming to Helium, I would get a chance to interview them, usually over the phone. And so I got to interview Doug one time. And I asked him, I'm just like, so do you think that marijuana will be legalized during Obama's administration? And he kind of hemmed and hawed for a minute. And he's just like, yeah, I think he will. Because he's black. Way to go, Doug. Fucking racist. And like that totally just caught him off guard. And so, but yeah, I got a chance to interview him, Lisa Lampanelli, Aisha Tyler, Chris Titus, a couple other cats as well. And so.
And this is all on your podcast?
No, this was, I got them recorded. I don't know. I just kind of sitting on them. I don't really know what to do with them for the most part.
Do you have guests on your podcast?
We used to. We used to have one a week. We would have somebody kind of come on and hang out with us. And we kind of, like, some of them were really good and some of them were just a complete miss. So. Yeah. We just decided to keep it, you know, just the two of us. And if, like, a extenuating circumstance comes along, then we can add, like, a special... Because I think we're going to have one for our 300th show. We're just going to have somebody on to hang out with us. Because I think that might be fun again.
Well, when you get to your 420th show, I can make a suggestion of who you should have on.
Who's that?
Oh, Doug Benson, of course.
He'll be president by then. It'll be kind of hard. He'll be
Yeah, probably.
Emperor-elect Doug Benson will be, overlord.
Write him in for the next election, everybody. You should totally do it, too.
Absolutely.
Legalize pot instantly. Like, Michelle Obama's garden in the back would just be gone. Weed. Yeah.
Get this gone. I don't want to see this any longer.
Yeah. But yeah, so, Jimmy, what do you want to plug?
I am doing the Fertile Ground Festival in Portland with both a character-based comedy show called All Caps and my sketch group. Well, it's not my sketch group. It's Josh and Wally's sketch group, and me and Scotty are stoked to be a part of it. But it's called Lance Life. And so that's at the end of January, early February.
All righty.
And I
Where can they check dates and times?
Fertileground.com.
Okay.
I would assume. And I'll be doing at the All Caps Festival, it will be me doing Daniel Plainview, but I'll have a little bit of a budget, so I'll actually get to do it in costume and maybe with some video production or other players, and so that's really exciting because...
Some squibs, maybe?
Yeah, right? Normally when I do Plainview, it's like nobody knows what the hell's happening, so you either love it or hate it, but to have an opportunity to do it where everybody knows what's going to happen, that's kind of exciting.
Yeah.
So that, you know, there won't be anybody that's just like, what is going on? Everybody will know what I'm there to do. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Awesome. Twitters.
I got one, but as I told Jimmy before, it's just a... It's like a neglected pet. It's just kind of, I have it, I think. I don't know. It's somewhere around. It's like Jim Willig, I think, or Jay. I don't even know what my handle is. That's how little I use it.
All right, I'll have some sort of link.
Thank you.
Something, yeah. I'll find it.
If you want to just look at an empty fucking Twitter page, by all means, please. Waste your life. Waste your life. Go ahead.
I'm pretty sure there's a, what is it? At one tweet. And somebody created this, and they had one tweet, and that's it.
Yeah,
but I'm
it
pretty
stays
sure
forever.
They, I think they have over 100,000 followers. Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. Twitter.
It's just Jimmy Neustetter, spelled like newsletter, but with a T. And right now, don't get confused because I've got a silly, fun Christmas name. It's Christmas Goosetter.
Yeah.
But the handle is still the same, Jimmy Neustetter.
All right, well, thank you very much, guys, for being on the podcast.
Thank you.
Really great time.
Thanks for
having
us.
Great show last night. We'll have a great show tonight. It'll be awesome.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Friday night, lots of old ladies and capes probably this time.
Yeah, exactly. Well, hopefully for Jimmy, it'll be Scepters. Asian businessmen.
Yes.
So his work will be cut out for him.
A little cash on the side.
Yeah.
And shamefully underage girls on acid, you know?
Yeah.
That's going to be the twofer.
Yeah, exactly. It'll be perfect night.
It should have been. They were old enough to be in a bar.
Yeah, serving, like, 18 maybe? Maybe?
Yeah.
That's rounding up several numbers.
Oh.
The prison I would go to for them.
All right. I think that's the end. Anything else you want to throw in there?
Peace, love, and chicken grease.
Okay. All right.
I concur.
All right.